So let me just remind you that last day we left off writing down this discretization scheme for the wave equation written in a first order form, the so-called Crank-Nicholson scheme, and this is the one that's implemented in this RMPL program. And this afternoon we're going to go through that RMPL program in some detail. And I think you'll find that it's relatively easy to understand what's going on, and with luck it'll be relatively easy for you to modify it to do the first homework. Okay, so was any question about what we did last day? All right, so as I promised, we're now going to go back to the basics. Yes, sir.
I'm misunderstanding, maybe you should think about it again. But so if you try to, you said that the equation we're using doesn't depend on phi, but only on its derivative.
Yeah.
So we can write it as derivatives.
That's right.
So the Klein-Gordon equation has like a phi squared in it.
This is a massless Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so I'd like to discuss a few, basically several fundamental concepts that apply to any finite difference approximation to any set of differential equations, not just partial differential equations, but also ordinary differential equations. Okay, so what we'll be generally interested in, of course, when we do such an approximation is the continuum limit. So we're going to be interested in the limit where the mesh spacing H, where the grid spacing, goes to zero. Now, whenever we do a specific calculation, we necessarily compute at some finite H. Okay? But we're going to be very interested in how the results change as a function of H. In fact, there's a basic rule that I tell all my starting students, which is if they're doing a finite difference calculation, they come to me with some sort of an answer, whether or not it's right or wrong. If they bring me something and they show me a calculation that's only been done at one resolution, I tell them to go away and repeat it at least, another resolution or maybe three or four. So a fundamental issue is that a calculation done at one specific resolution, that is using one mesh spacing, is essentially incomplete. And when you do that kind of, when you adopt that sort of approach, you're not being serious, as it were, about your numerical analysis. As we'll see, you can always get a direct estimate of the error in the solution of a finite difference equation by simply doing this process of computing with the same initial data, the same parameters, the different mesh spacings, comparing the two solutions. Okay, so it's like doing an experiment. If you remember back to your labs, when you wrote up your labs, you fail, you get a lot of marks taken off if you didn't do the error analysis. Same thing here. There's no excuse for not doing error analysis. It's important because it's an approximation technique. And in some sense, it's the most important thing. Because if you can show that the error in your solution is going to zero, then you know that you're solving the problem. Okay? So fundamentally, we expect the error to go to zero as H goes to zero. Okay. So let's write an arbitrary general differential system in this rather abstract form. LU is equal to F. Okay? If you want, you can think of U as our function phi that we discussed, a function of one time variable in space. But the discussion applies to cases of more than one independent variable, as many as you want. We'll typically be restricting ourselves to three space dimensions, but of course, if you're interested in string theory, there might be, 9 or 10 space dimensions. That doesn't matter. There can be multiple dependent variables, right? All of this discussion goes through independent of that. Also, L, which is a differential operator, so in our case, it's simply second partial t minus second partial x, is linear in this case, but it doesn't necessarily have to be linear. So Dennis, maybe you should, if you could, just ask the IT people whether, I think, because if they can get going on the
installation.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay, so use the unknown, f is some specified function, given function, it might be a function of u, but it's not gonna be a differential function of u, there'll be no derivatives acting there, and we'll frequently call that a source function, okay? So there's our abstract representation of any differential system. Okay, we've ignored boundary conditions, but that's not really an issue right here. Okay, so now we're going to be talking about a so-called exact solution or the continuum solution. That's the solution U that satisfies a differential system, and now we'll be considering an approximation. So we'll find difference approximation. So what we're going to do is put a superscript H on the unknown, right, to emphasize that this is going to be a solution which satisfies a finite difference equation. So a general finite difference approximation to that equation will be written in this form. So we have the operator LH acting on the discrete solution UH is equal to this discrete source function FH. Okay? So again, UH is the discrete solution, FH is some specified function. We've just evaluated on the mesh, as it were, and LH is the finite difference approximation, and we're assuming that in the limit that H goes to zero, we're going to recover the continuum solution. Now, we define the finite, when we calculate, a finite difference solution is always computed on a mesh, okay? However, it's actually useful to think of that finite difference solution as being defined on the continuum, because that helps with the sort of non-rigorous error analysis that I'm going to outline. Okay, so even though in practice, when you compute a solution, you know, UH on this grid, it'll only be defined formally or precisely on these grid points, we can nonetheless think of it as being extended to the continuum. So say we have a value here, a value here, a value here, a value here, and a value there. Okay? In order to extend it to the continuum, we can think of doing polynomial interpolation in the mesh to a suitably high order. And that will give us some sort of a at least piecewise smooth function, which is defined on the continuum. Okay? So it's useful to bear that in mind, that we can think of UH as actually being defined on the continuum. Okay? Right, so straightforward. Now, we're going to canonicalize that system simply by subtracting right-hand side from both sides. So we're going to write the finite difference approximation in this form, LH, UH minus FH is equal to zero. Obviously, for any equation, I can always canonicalize it in that form. But it's a useful thing to do for a couple of reasons. So first of all, we have this canonical view now of what it means to solve the finite difference approximation. It means we want to drive this right, this left-hand side to zero. All right? And in particular, especially for the equations of the type I mentioned yesterday, which include the equations that result from this Crank-Nicholson approximation of the wave equations, the equations cannot be solved directly, explicitly, for the individual grid function unknowns. And it may turn out to be very expensive to solve the resulting linear system directly using, for example, LU decomposition. And so in cases like that, it's often useful to use an iterative technique. Okay? And when we do that, it's useful to introduce this concept of a residual, which is simply the level to which the finite difference approximation is not satisfied. Right? So now we introduce another little bit of notation. We put a tilde over U. So UH is the exact solution of the difference equations. Tilde means this is our working solution, or you know, during the course of an iteration, the instantaneous solution. It's some approximation to the exact solution of the difference equations, which in turn is an approximation to the continuum solution. So we define the residual simply by substituting U tilde H in here, and then in general we'll get a non-zero result, and that's simply the residual. And for any algebraic expression, that's what we'll mean by a residual. So a residual is a quantity which should go to zero in some limit. In this case, it'll be generally in the limit of infinite iteration. So a convergent iterative process, then, is one which drives the residual to zero. And we'll see that RNPL is set up so that basically you specify residuals for a set of equations, and then RNPL can figure out how to set up code in order to generate an iterative method which drives those residuals to zero in most cases. Okay? Yes, sir.
Do we have any way of knowing if our iterative method is stable or unstable?
No, in general, for certain classes of equations and approximations, there's convergence theory, but we often sort of adopt an empirical approach. If it works, okay, we're happy with it. If it doesn't, then we're going to have to sit down and possibly do some additional work. So for the kinds of equations we're going to be looking at in this course, where we need to use this kind of iteration, the iteration generally converges. Okay. Next definition, the notion of truncation error. So the truncation error, tau h, of a finite difference approximation is defined as follows. It looks exactly like the expression for the residual, but now I'm putting the continuum solution u into the finite difference approximation. Okay? The continuum solution, not the discrete solution. So obviously this is not going to be zero. Right? So u satisfies the continuum PDE. Yes, sir. LH is a difference operator, right?
Okay, but so the difference operator
should be... Well, for example, the first derivative was f of x plus h minus f x minus h, right? So I can apply that to any continuum function, right?
Okay.
All right? And again, you know, if we bear in mind this view that we can always kind of take grid functions and represent them on the continuum through some sort of interpolation process, there's no problem sort of switching back and forth. Now, the form of the truncation error can always be computed, typically using Taylor series, and I know you all went home and dutifully did those exercises, right? Well, maybe not, I don't know. But anyway, when you get around to doing that, you'll see that you can compute the actual form of the truncation error. It'll depend on derivatives of u and use the unknown function, of course, and you don't know what u is a priori, but that's not the issue. The form can always be computed. But you see that it's basically, it's analogous to a residual. In particular, it involves the action of an operator on the solution. Okay, so it's different from what we'll call the solution error, which is the difference between the continuum solution and the discrete solution. Yes, sir.
I expect the number t, h, to be dependent on the solution, right? What is a good number, a good amount?
Sorry?
10 to the minus 55.
What, the smallness? Of
yeah.
Oh, well, that depends on the order of approximation, the nonlinearity of the equations, what sort of features you have, how steep the gradients are. But typically, for the kinds of techniques that we're discussing here, first or second order finite difference techniques, if you have something, say, a few hundred grid points resolving, say, a couple of wavelengths, then you would expect your error to be, you know, 0.1%, maybe a little bit less, but certainly not 10 to the minus 15 or so, okay? So we're not talking about going to the last decimal digit at all with these sorts of techniques, okay? All right, any questions about that? These notions are all very simple, but important. Except let's discuss convergence. So again, we're going to assume that the finite difference approximation is characterized by this single discretization scale H, and then we'll say that the approximation converges if and only if UH goes to U as H goes to zero. Okay? And in practice, that's our chief concern. As numerical analysts, we want to make sure that our process is converging. Okay? And we want to pay attention to that, especially if we're sure, or we suspect, we can never be really sure, but if we suspect that the solutions of the PDEs are good models for the real phenomena. So in some sense, this is what we do when we solve PDEs in numerical relativity isn't simulation, although you'll hear that term used a lot. To me and to a lot of other people, simulation implies that your model doesn't capture exactly the underlying physics. That there, you sort of come up with something that has the features that you're looking for, but somehow, you know, if you really push on it, there's something missing there. With Einstein's equations, for example, and the two-body problem for two black holes, there's a good reason to believe that if Einstein's theory is correct, then that modeling of two black holes using the vacuum Einstein equations is an incredibly accurate model, and therefore it makes sense to take the solution of that mathematical problem very seriously and try to solve it as precisely as possible. In the simulation problem, if you'd forgotten physics at the level of 20 or 30%, then clearly it wouldn't make much sense to solve any particular instance of your model to, you know, a tenth of a percent or better, right? You'd be calculating a very accurate solution to an inaccurate model, but that's not the case here. And so convergence is particularly important in fields like numerical relativity, where we have a good reason to believe that the mathematics is really modeling the physics that we're interested in. Okay, notion of consistency. So this is, there's essentially two key things that come into convergence of a finite difference scheme. One is consistency, the other is stability, and we won't be able to discuss stability in much detail. But if we assume that we have a finite difference approximation with some truncation error tau h, and again characterized by a single discretization scale, then we say that that approximation is consistent if the truncation error goes to zero as h goes to zero. Okay? So in other words, as h goes to zero, if the continuum solution satisfies that finite difference approximation better and better, then we have a consistent discretization. And it's obviously a necessary condition for convergence. If you don't have consistency in your difference scheme, as could happen, for example, if you misdifferenced a derivative, right? So you wrote down an approximation, what you thought was an approximation to a derivative, but it really wasn't. You know, maybe it was an approximation to a second derivative or something like that. Then your solution won't converge. Yeah?
If we're doing this calculation, that means we don't know the exact solution, right?
Yep.
So we can't really calculate the truncation?
No. Truncation error, the form of the truncation error, you always can. The form of it. Okay, right, and that from that and the equations of motion, we'll see an example, you can always tell whether or not the scheme is consistent. But basically it means that you've replaced the differential operators with good approximations.
You mean you can solve pencil on paper?
Absolutely, in closed form. The order of a finite difference approximation. Again, you assume that the approximation is characterized by this single discretization scale. Then we say that it's pth order accurate, or simply pth order, if tau h is order h to the p for some integer p. And we'll typically be looking at second order schemes. And although both schemes we looked at yesterday are second orders, so p is 2. The solution error. Again, this is distinct from the truncation error, and some people will call this solution error truncation error. But when I say truncation error, I'm talking about taking the continuum solution, sticking it in the difference equation. And so that's a quantity like the residual when we're iterating to find the solution to the difference equations. The solution error is the real error, u minus uh, or uh minus u, doesn't really matter. Yes, sir.
Sorry, can you go back to the previous slide? I have a question about that.
Yeah.
Do you mean that limit goes asymptotically like h to the p and is not equal to h to the p? Because don't you want that limit to be zero?
Well, I want the leading order term to be order h to
okay,
the p.
Okay, so you want tau h to be asymptotic to h to the p as h is
yeah.
Zero.
Okay, it's just very loose notation here.
Okay.
So solution error is simply what I get by taking the exact solution minus the discrete solution. I won't be able to calculate it exactly in most cases, of course, because if I could, then you know, I'd be able to calculate the exact solution. But the thing is, with finite difference approximations, we can estimate EH rather well. So now we consider the relationship between truncation error and solution error. And so what one would sort of assume is that if we have an order h to the p truncation error, then we would expect to get an order h to the p solution error. And this assumption is often warranted, but it's extremely instructive to consider why it is. And we're going to follow Richardson, a paper written 100 years ago. And I'll take a little aside here to tell you a little bit about Richardson in case you don't know about him. Boyd Richardson sort of invented numerical weather forecasting. And you can imagine in 1910 that there weren't any digital computers. But he had computers. They were people, mostly boys, 7 or 8 years younger than you guys probably are. And he had large numbers of those sitting in big rooms with big sheets of paper doing finite difference calculations. The four digits, you know, floating point multiplies and divides. He paid them sort of pennies, you know, some sort of piecemeal rate. He called them computers in his papers. So if you go and read this paper, it says, the chief problem with the computers has been the admixture of plus and minus signs. And he had people, he had the boys check each other's work, so each calculation was done twice, and he didn't pay you if you got an answer wrong. And some of the kids were amazingly fast at doing these calculations. I guess, you know, if you sat there and did them all day, that's what happened. And he had this vision of having entire, you know, gymnasium airplane hangars full of people doing these finite difference calculations, right? And unfortunately, he chose a really bad application. He was trying to predict the weather in the UK in 1910, you know, with a finite difference mesh that was basically, you know, one grid point for every 50 kilometers or something. So, of course, it didn't work very well. But he really had the foresight, and he sort of saw the whole thing, right? So hats off to Mr. Richardson. And this bit about issue in more detail later, it's because I've been lazy and I'm just reorganizing notes, so we're going to discuss it now. So again, this, yes? Absolutely. Lloyd F. Richardson. Yeah. So the discussion here applies to essentially any continuum problem which is solved using finite difference approximations on a uniform mesh structure. That is, one in which the mesh spacings are constant in each of the coordinate directions, and ideally, basically the same constant, which you can always, if they're constant in each coordinate direction, then through a rescaling, you can effectively make them constant. So even though we're concerned mostly with hyperbolic problems, time-dependent problems, this is going to apply to the treatment of ODEs and elliptic problems. And for those kinds of problems, convergence is often easier to achieve due to the fact that we don't have problems with stability. Now, we're not going to discuss stability in any great, in fact, we're not going to discuss it at all, I think. I'll just leave it to you to read the notes. But given consistency, essentially for time-dependent problems, it can be proven for a large class of problems, but it's a good rule of thumb that given consistency, stability and convergence are equivalent. So you can't have a convergent finite difference scheme which isn't stable, and you can't have a stable finite difference scheme which doesn't converge. Okay? So we'll be interested in convergence here. If the mesh is non-uniform, then the picture that I'm going to draw doesn't completely hold, but at least locally it'll hold. And the picture doesn't get too distorted, but it does get distorted, and it's beyond the scope of these notes. But it's really difficult to overstate the importance of the convergence studies. I can stand up here and talk about this forever. Once you start doing the calculations, you'll see, right? So, and it's one of those things that, you know, it really will change your attitude towards this, I hope, once you start seeing the power of that kind of approach. So we can actually do quite a bit of work with an even simpler model equation for a time-dependent system. Sort of this is the simplest possible equation of hyperbolic type. It's sort of like you take the square root of the advection equation, or you factor of the wave equation. You factor the wave equation into left and right moving parts, and you throw away one part. Okay, so it's of this form. Ut is AUX, where A is greater than 0, and we can actually, you can set A equals 1, but I won't here. Okay, and here we need initial conditions of the form U at the initial time is equal to U naught, some profile. I'm going to solve this on the unit interval, but just to add a little twist, I'm going to use periodic boundary conditions, or if you will, I'm solving it on S1, so I'm identifying X is equal to 0 and X is equal to 1. So basically, this advection equation is going to describe the motion of disturbances which propagate in one direction around a circle, okay? But in one direction only, because this is a first-order equation. And the way that we've written this, the solutions will move to the left. So if I have initial data U0x, I can immediately write down the full solution. I just look at the characteristics for the problem. characteristics are very easy. They're just straight lines with slope A in the space-time plane. Okay, so my characteristics look like this. They all move to the left, the slope is equal to A, and because I'm on this finite domain, x equals 0 to x equals 1, basically, you know, the characteristic that comes out there reappears here. Okay, it just wraps around. So get the solution at any time, at any point, a space point, all I have to do is look back along this characteristic and pick up the initial solution. And then as it keeps wrapping, I keep doing that. Okay, so very straightforward. So that's the solution. So it's simply A plus U naught evaluated at x plus AT mod 1. Right, so throw away anything to the left of the decimal point, just keep a number between 0 and 1. Yeah?
X plus AT, so why are the negatives something?
X plus AT. Yeah, that's right. It's moving to the right. Sorry, people. I'm making people confused. I could say that A was negative.
So this is moving to the right. It's minus AT, right?
Yeah, it is moving to the left. It's X plus AT. Yeah, it is moving to the left. Because X plus AT is constant.
Moves to the left, but the slope is negative.
Sorry. We've got the X plus AT is equal to constant. So in general, that means that t is equal to minus x over a, right? So the slope is negative. OK? So it was correct. Moves to the left. All right, the characteristic is defined by that. And that means that the slope is a negative. You know, I always get it confused once code it up, you see it moving, then it makes sense. But the real issue is that there's one set of characteristics. Okay, so we can actually perform a rather complete closed form treatment of the convergence here, but the point of this exercise is not to advocate that this is what you should do for complicated problems, but rather to give you some insight into what's happening in the convergence of these kinds of problems. And again, the key idea is to be extracted is that in principle, and always and in practice, and by that I mean I've never seen a case where it doesn't work, but you know, I haven't seen there's a lot of calculations I haven't seen. But the principle and the thing that Richardson really identified is that the error of a finite difference approximation in some sense is no less computable than the solution itself. And that's a very powerful principle, obviously. Okay, so that has widespread ramifications. Again, one of them is that there's no excuse for plotting solutions of finite difference approximations without error bars or their equivalents, or at least being able to say, this is what I think the level of error is. OK, so let's attack the advection equation using second order finite difference techniques. So we need approximations for the first space and first time derivative. We adopt the usual finite difference notation. So again, that labels the time index, the spatial index on a uniform mesh. So we have the usual approximations for the order h squared centered space derivative and the time derivative. We'll take delta x to be h, delta t to be lambda delta x, or lambda h. We'll hold lambda fixed as h varies, so that the approximation is characterized by the single discretization parameter h. Okay. Now, again, I've already mentioned this, but the first key idea behind this analysis is we want to view the solution of the finite difference approximation as a continuum problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to expand everything that lives in the discrete domain in terms of expansions in the parameter h involving continuum quantities, continuum operators, continuum functions. Okay? So we're going to expand these operators and also the finite difference solution in terms of functions which really are defined and operators which really are defined on the continuum. So you can verify that we have the following expansions for the finite difference operators. We've already seen something like this yesterday. So we have the difference operator is equal to the derivative operator plus 1/6 h squared times the third derivative operator plus something which is order h to the fourth. And the same thing for the time derivative. So in terms of this general abstract formulation that we just wrote down, we have LU minus F is equal to 0. Here it's dt minus A dx U is equal to 0. Our difference scheme LHUH minus FH is equal to 0 is this finite difference operator dt minus A dx acting on UH is equal to 0. And the truncation error is simply what we get by taking this operator and applying it to the continuum solution, right? And then using these expansions, we can quickly work out that that's equal to 1/6 h squared lambda squared the third time minus a times the third space derivative all acting on u. And so this is what I mean by you can always compute the form of the truncation error explicitly in terms of higher derivatives acting on u. Okay, so that's our truncation error. The second key idea behind error analysis, and this is this, the central thing that Richardson wrote down. Yes, sir?
Are the a and the lambda related?
No. A is the speed of propagation. We can set it equal to 1. Lambda is the ratio of the time step to the space step. It'll typically be of order 1. It'll be less than 1 for stability. Think of it as being, you know, a half or a quarter or some fixed value. Okay. So Richardson wrote down what I call an ansatz. It's basically an assumption. He did it on the basis of some work that Lord Rayleigh did investigating the modes of a string by approximating the string as a bunch of beads or point masses connected by little springs. So you're sort of doing some kind of finite difference analysis but using ordinary differential equations. And he observed there was a sort of regular pattern in the way that the values that he computed converged as a function of the resolution. So Richardson took that, and he was actually, the problem he was involved with when he published his 1910 paper was computing stresses in a dam. And so he was, you know, doing a real life sort of engineering problem. But he wrote down that, he said it's well known that if you approximate your differential system with second order finite difference approximations, which are centered, that is, that they always sort of symmetric with respect to x goes to minus x, then you'll have this following expansion, that the discrete solution UH is the continuum solution plus h squared times some smooth function, or at least a function which has smoothness comparable to u, plus h to the fourth times some other function, etc. Okay. Now, this is a very powerful statement because this is explicit H dependence of this unknown difference function, of the discrete solution. Okay? E2 and E4, et cetera, are H independent. Okay? So again, use the continuum solution. These are error functions. They don't depend on H. And I'll call this a Richardson expansion. And it's the key expression from which all error analysis of finite difference approximations arises. Yes, sir?
Is there any way to depend on odd powers of h?
Well, okay, so if your truncation error has only even powers of h, then it's basically just consistency. So we'll see this when we work through the example. Right, well, at least we'll see it for this example. Okay? But if the finite difference approximation is not completely centered, then we may have to modify the ansatz. So in particular, if our scheme is only first order accurate, then in general we'll pick up a term which is where there's a first order error function and maybe a cubic, etc. Okay? Now, the Richardson expansion is completely compatible with this assertion, namely that if we have second order truncation error, we should expect a second order solution error. Okay? But it says a lot more than that. Again, you basically know what the form of this expansion tells you, what a lot of information about the information that's contained in the error functions. Okay? So in particular, it dictates the precise form of the H dependence of this discrete solution. Again, the key thing is these error functions, that should be E2, the error functions do not depend on H. So let's proceed with this error analysis then. So we'll start from the finite difference approximation. LH, UH minus FH is equal to zero. And now we're going to replace both the difference operator and the difference solution with continuum expansions. So we have LH, UH is equal to zero. So LH can be written as dt minus a dx. UH, we insert the Richardson expansion. We replace dt by this expansion, a dx by this expansion, and we're neglecting terms of order h to the fourth and higher. And so we've got this times this. Okay. Now, if you multiply everything out, now you've got terms of various order in h. And for that whole expression to vanish, the terms have to vanish order by order in h. So let's pick up the zeroth order term, the order one term. So that's everything that doesn't have an h. So we get dt here, adx here, acting on u. And that's the only zeroth order term. And so that tells us that dt minus adx u is equal to zero. And that's the original differential equation. So that's the consistency condition, right? So from that, we know that our finite difference approximation is consistent. Okay, fair enough. But the interesting thing is what we get at second order. So at second order, and you can verify this, after rearrangement, where we put the E2 on the left-hand side and terms evolving higher derivatives of U on the right-hand side, we see that we get a wave, an advection equation, an equation of exactly the same type as we had for the continuum solution for the error function with a non-zero source function. Now, that only makes sense, right? So if I have this equation whose solution in the continuum represents wave propagation, and the discrete solution has an approximate solution, and that approximate solution is also propagating, then clearly the difference between them also propagates. Okay? So there's nothing surprising there, but the interesting thing is that E2 essentially satisfies the same partial differential equation, but with the source function. Okay? Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a heuristic error analysis, but it captures basically if you do finite differencing on a uniform mesh with consistently second-order finite difference schemes, you'll always see this kind of behavior. You can, you know, rather easily convince yourself that nothing else can happen. Or the calculation.
You analyze the E2. You do the same analysis for E2 now. So you can subtract the error.
That's right. So we'll get to that. That's exactly the point of Richardson extrapolation. But even before we get there, the key thing to keep in mind is that these E2, these error functions, you know, we're used to thinking of error, especially in numerical analysis, being some kind of random willy-nilly error. Well, the error functions in an approximation, a finite difference approximation, aren't random at all. They satisfy differential equations themselves. So this is another point. When you think of taking a continuum problem and then approximating it, there's sort of this natural tendency to think that you've simplified matters. But it couldn't be more the opposite. Once you write down a finite difference solution, you've actually made things much more complicated. And the phenomenology of finite difference equations is much more complicated and richer than differential system. And one way you can sort of see that already is that effectively what we're doing when we're solving a finite difference system is solving an entire infinite hierarchy of continuum problems, one order by order at h. Okay? Key thing here, though, is the governing equation for E2 is of precisely the same nature. And so, in fact, we can go ahead and we can solve that for E2. So the natural initial conditions are that the error function at the initial time, E2 and also all the other ones, is zero, right? We assume that we start the solution with exact initial data. And so if we initialize that finite difference approximation with that exact solution, so that E2 at x0 is zero, and we define Q of x plus AT to be this, then we can write down that E2 is simply T times Q. Okay? And that's typical, I'd say it's typical for this leapfrog method. That's what this particular difference scheme is called. We have linear growth of the finite difference error with time. Okay? But you can actually, you know, if, as long as you know U, you can compute the exact form of E2. Yes, sir.
That's bad, right?
No, that's something that we have to live with. It's hard for something which is dynamic. If it was oscillating, for example, we could maybe come up with a method where the error was bounded. But for general systems, you're going to have to live with something like that. Starting from zero, right? And it will converge to sort of order h squared. So the slope goes down quadratically, right? So, it's not too surprising. Okay, so we can extend that analysis to higher order in H, and I've already intimated that. So what results is an entire hierarchy of differential equations for U and the error functions at higher and higher order in H. Okay, so it's useful to keep that view in mind. When you're solving a finite difference approximation, you're not solving a simplified system, you're actually solving a much richer system. Okay? All right, so now on to sort of practicalities. This notion of doing convergence tests. So in general, we're not going to be able to solve the governing PDE exactly and do this in error analysis, or else we wouldn't be doing the numerical analysis to begin with. We would just solve the problem and get on with it. Okay? But this is where the power of Richardson's observation is really evident, i.e. when we don't have the ability to do the error analysis and we don't know what the exact solution is. So starting from that expansion and simply computing the finite difference solutions using the same initial data, same problem parameters, but different values of H, we can learn a lot about the error in the approximations. And I've said that many times. I want to keep saying it so that, you get so bored of it that you start believing it, and you'll do it automatically. You're kind of, quotes, fresh meat. You're unsullied by bad programming practices, bad numerical analysis practices, so you can get off to a good start here. So convergence testing is essentially this whole game of investigating what happens to the finite difference approximation as H varies. And you don't want to end up using convergence testing as a black box. You want to adopt it as a methodology. Depending on what equation you're solving, what system you're solving, you may have to tailor the convergence tests. So it's something that you have to gain experience with, but the fundamental assumption and the fundamental analysis always goes back to the existence or non-existence of these Richardson expansions. Okay, so here's a specific kind of convergence test of the type that we're going to use, and that's illustrated in this sample RMPL program that you already took a look at last day. So we compute three distinct finite difference solutions. We need a minimum of three to do this convergence test, UH, U2H, and U4H. So this is done with the coarsest mesh. This is done with the finest mesh. It's convenient to use meshes which are in 2-to-1 ratio. And that, why do we do that? Well, for one thing, then we can have grid points corresponding to different levels of discretization line up, and we don't have to do any interpolation, right? So on a fine mesh, on a coarse mesh, we just take every second grid point of the fine mesh, and we can do a direct subtraction. We could do a different ratio, like a 3-to-1, but it's not as efficient computationally, especially in multiple dimensions. So we're also going to assume that these finite difference meshes line up, so that the 4H grid points are a subset of the 2H points, which are a subset of the H points. We'll always do that. Well, I could be kind of silly and shift the grid, right? But yeah, so there's yes, sir. Yeah.
So why do we have to worry about doing the finite solution for 2H and 4H?
Okay, because so we know in principle that the order is H squared, and in practice it will be order H squared if you haven't screwed anything up. Right? So if there haven't been any mistakes made from what you wrote down on paper to what's coming out on the computer screen. Now for very complicated equations, the chances of you not screwing up anybody not screwing up go to zero very rapidly. And so this becomes basically our safety net. It's our mechanism by which we can make progress on a daily basis without having to be superhuman in our, carefulness, our accuracy, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So imagine that you've got this really messy system of partial differential equations. You have no clue what the solution is. Okay, in principle, this will let you tell when you've got the right solution. So that's all we want. Okay? Okay, so for the Richardson and ansatz, we expect the following then, UH, U2H, and U4H. So we simply write down the expansion, and the only thing that varies is what H is. So in all cases, we have the same error functions, we have the same continuum solution, and here we just have H squared, 2H all squared, 4H all squared. Then we'll compute a quantity with the note QT, we'll call that a convergence factor. And what we'll do is we'll subtract 4H from 2H. So this is a pointwise subtraction done on the set of grid points which are common to the two meshes. And then we define a spatial norm. Now, I'll say it's closer to a discrete version of a measure. If you look in usual numerical analysis textbooks, when they take a norm of a vector, they don't relativize it or divide it by the number of grid points, but we always will. Because otherwise, the size of solutions on different meshes is different, which doesn't make any sense. Okay, so this discrete norm is just the RMS value. Okay, so I sum up the squares, I divide by the number of values, and I take the square root. It could be any other. It could be you could take the max norm or any p norm, as long as you sort of convert it to a discrete measure by dividing by the number of grid points. So we do that using 4h minus 2h. And we divide it by U2H minus UH, and then we're going to get a scalar function of time. And it's a sort of an overall global view of how the scheme is converging. Okay? So if we stick those expansions into that, then it's simple to show, we go back, when I subtract these, right, the U terms disappear. Right? And when I have 4H minus 2H, I get 16H squared minus 4H squared is 12H squared up here times E2. And down here, I get 2H squared minus H squared, which is 3H squared times E2. The E2s cancel when I divide, and I get left with a factor of 4 in the limit that H goes to 0 if the scheme is converging. Okay? So, limit of H goes to 0, Q of T is 4. In practice, you can use additional levels of discretization, as many as you possibly can, so that you can look for trends in that quantity. So Q of T won't be exactly 4. It'll have some time dependence. But it should approach the constant 4 for all time as H goes to 0. Okay. Now, once you've established the finite difference approximation really is converging, and you really can use this sort of test. I mean, if you've made a mistake and you've replaced the derivative incorrectly, so it's not, you're computing something which isn't a derivative, the scheme won't converge at all, and you won't get anything close to 4. Or if you've made a mistake in the differencing, and rather than having a second order approximation, you've constructed a scheme which is only first order accurate, then you're likely to find that this is 2. Okay, and so you can detect all sorts of errors, and in principle, essentially all errors, simply by doing convergence tests. There's one other type of test that we'll probably discuss in the lab, but that's the key observation. And this is very, very easy to do. Okay, as long as you're set up to do it computationally, all you have to do is rerun the calculation with a different resolution, subtract the solution, take some norms, and compute this factor. Okay. And so now we come to the observation that simply by subtracting two solutions, the simplest possible thing you could do, compute a solution on some mesh, refine that mesh, right, so this is a coarse mesh, it's a fine mesh, subtract them, and putting in the Richardson expansions, what we find is, again, the U's disappear, we have 3H squared E2, right? But that's simply 3 times the leading order error term. Right? So up to a constant factor of 3, you get this direct estimate of the error simply by subtracting the two solutions. And that will always work. Independent of the equation, the order of approximation, da-da-da. Okay, so I'll leave this for you to study. So this forms the basis for Richardson extrapolation, by which you can actually, once you know that you're in a converging limit, you can combine, take linear combinations of the solutions at different levels of discretization to eliminate the error terms and therefore increase the accuracy of the different schemes. We won't talk about it much in detail here. It's very effective when you're solving ODEs. It's relatively less effective for the solution of PDEs for many reasons, but if the solutions are sufficiently smooth, you can always go to higher order just by writing down higher order partial finite difference approximations to the partial differential equations. Okay, so we won't have to worry about Richardson extrapolation. The last thing I want to discuss is this notion of independent residual evaluation, which together with convergence tests sort of gives you a complete methodology for ensuring that your solution really is the solution that you set out to find. So if you do convergence testing and you see that a solution is converging, you say, okay, I have this convergent solution, but how do I know that I'm converging to the solution of the continuum problem? And the convergence test by itself will not tell you that. So if somebody had given you a set of equations to solve, and in transcribing it, you'd flip the sign in a term, and in flipping the sign of the term, you didn't kill the well-posedness of the problem, so the problem still had a solution. You went ahead and computed that solution, you'd see it was converging, right? But it's not converging to what your boss wanted you to find. So how do you detect that? So we introduced this notion of an independent residual evaluation, and essentially it amounts to checking to see whether or not your solution satisfied the original equations. Okay, so it's the sort of technique that you're taught in grade one or two, you know, when you're doing mathematics, as much as possible, always check your answers, and, you know, there's really nothing more to it than that. So here's the idea. Again, we have the continuum PDE written in the form LU minus F is equal to zero with a finite difference approximation LHUH minus FH is equal to zero. We assume that UH is apparently converging. So, for example, we do this convergence test. We've had a second order approximation. It looks like it's tending to four as H tends to zero. But we don't know whether we've derived our finite difference approximation correctly or whether we've implemented the discrete operator correctly or a host of other problems that could have arisen. Okay? So in order to check that the solution is converging to you, what we do is we write down a second and independent discretization of that differential system. So in other words, we change how we do the finite differencing. And there's lots of ways of doing that in general, right? So rather than using a centered scheme, maybe we use a backward scheme for the derivatives. Doesn't really matter, as long as it's a distinct different scheme. Okay? So that's a distinct operator, L tilde. The source function is still the same. It defines a distinct grid function, U tilde, which will not coincide with UH in general. But we're not going to compute U tilde H. Okay? What we're going to do is we're going to take this discretization and apply that to the solution that we're computing and see what we get. Okay? So this is going to be used as an evaluator or an operator, simply as an operator. We're going to take the output from our calculation to compute UH, apply L tilde H on it, and see what happens as a function of the mesh scale. So as with LH, we can expand L tilde H in powers of the mesh spacing. So L tilde H is going to be, again, assuming that everything's been done to second order, but that doesn't really matter. You know, the whole thing works through independent of what order the discretization is. So we have the continuum operator plus H squared times some higher order differential operator plus H to the fourth times some even higher order differential operator, etc. Okay, now we're simply going to apply L tilde to UH. So if UH is converging to our continuum solution with the, and because we've found that it's converging at second order, then it must, to leading order, be U plus H squared E2 if we're getting the right solution. Okay? So we take L tilde H and we operate on UH, and then insert that expansion, so we have L plus H squared E2 acting on U plus H squared E2. So at first order, zeroth order, I should say, the order one term is L acting on U. Okay. At second order, at order h squared, we have two terms. We have E2 acting on U, and we have L acting on E2. Okay. Now, one problem with this is I've dropped this f of h here. So there actually should be a minus f of h in here. Okay. And so I'll get an LU minus F here, but that vanishes. And then I get a quantity, which is H squared. Okay? So that's the key thing. If this was converging, but this was not the continuum solution, then when I take that differential operator and act on U and subtract F, I will not get zero. I will get some other function, some function. And so when I do this, I will not see a residual quantity. Right? I will not see a quantity which is vanishing with some power of h as h goes to zero. I will see some function. And that tells me immediately that I'm not computing the continuum solution. Okay? And conversely, if you do this check, and in fact, you know, I tell my students that this is the first thing that they should code for complicated equations, because this is you know, if you're building a house, a tall structure, you put up some scaffolding. Right? Doesn't make any sense to put up the scaffolding after you start building the building, right? You need to do that first. This is sort of your scaffolding. Okay, so you code that first because it's very easy. It's just an applicator. You don't have to solve anything, and then you're ready to take the output from your computer code that's computing that solution UH, and making sure that you get something which is order h squared. It's a decidedly non-trivial process, and when everything's working, you get this warm, fuzzy feeling about actually computing the right solution.
How do we get this out of
Well, so for example, it was the wave equation. I'll leave it to you to think of some different discretization. But we've already written down two discretizations for that, right? So if we were using the Crank-Nicholson, we could use that. Well, we couldn't do it directly because with the Crank-Nicholson scheme, we're not dealing with the scalar field itself. But you can replace, rather than using the centered space derivatives, and center time derivatives, you can use backwards differences, forward differences, whatever you want. Okay, so there's a little bit of art there, but it's not difficult in practice to choose something which is independent. Okay, so the key thing is that this independent residual will be residual. Like, if it's not, if you're getting some sort of constant function, then you know that something's wrong, and you can go away and try to figure out what's going wrong. It doesn't give you detailed information about where the error might be, but it gives you a very strong check once everything is working, or it gives you a sort of a strong assertion that things are working, and you can be very confident that you've got the solution. Okay? So any questions about that? So I just go on here that so if we have U2H minus UH going to 0 as H goes to 0, then we must have something like UH is equal to U plus E0, where this is order 1. And then if we just go through this again, what we find is, of course, we pick up this LE0 part. And if this is some arbitrary function, this is, you know, there's no reason for it to satisfy the original differential equation, unless we were really, really, really lucky / unlucky. Right? The chances of that happening are extraordinarily slim. Okay. So a few more comments about it. So if you don't get a residual value, so the problem is there could be difficulty with the discrete solution you're computing, but there could also be a difficulty with the way you've implemented this check. Okay. So as much as possible, you want to ensure that that independent residual evaluator is correct. And you can do that by using symbolic manipulation, for example, to generate the evaluator for you. Because that's all that evaluator has to do is basically evaluate things. You don't have to do any solution. There's no sort of, if you have to do some sort of a fancy solution technique to solve the difference equations, you don't have to do that here. And so what you want to do is, as much as possible, make it manifest that this independent residual evaluator is correct. That is, it is consistent with the differential equations that you want to solve. Okay? And again, All of this works for completely arbitrary systems, nonlinearities, time dependence. You know, so it's a completely generic and very powerful tool. And I'll leave the discussion of stability for self-study, and I think that'll do it for today, at least for this part, and we'll pick it up in the tutorial this afternoon. With luck, make sure that you turn on your laptops, check to see whether the command RMPL works. That should return with a usage message. See whether XVS starts up a GUI. And if you want to play around before the tutorial with stuff, go online and do that. Make sure that your laptops have been turned on, though, for at least a half an hour or so before you come to the tutorial session. Because there will be an update automatically done. But it won't, of course, it can't be updated until your machine's on.